Okay, good morning. Today our second speaker in this workshop is Professor Isaac Mbayi from Tel Aviv University. And he will talk about the title of the presentation is the 1948 War over Palestine and the Just War Theory. And you have, as I told you, 35 to 40 minutes for the presentation.
Yeah, okay. So I thought that when I sent this title to Alejandro, I thought that I'm going to write a paper directly on this war. It didn't happen. I didn't have the time. So I'm going to talk about a deeply related issue, and I will explain how it is related immediately. But first, Alejandro, thank you very much for this invitation. Girona is really a lovely little town, and I enjoyed it a lot, and thank you for letting me be here. So the project I'm engaged in nowadays will explore central normative questions that the war of 100 years, over 100 years, on Palestine between Arab and Jews raises. It focuses in particular on the jus ad bellum and the jus in bello of the 1948 war. Since I'm not an historian, I base this project on a factual analysis drawn from Benny Morris's historiography of this war. It is called 1948. And properly understood, the Morris account presents the conflict as involving four different wars. The first is a minimalist Arab war. Arabs in Palestine and outside Palestine fought against displacement as well as against becoming second class citizens in a Jewish state. The second war is a maximalist war fought by Arabs within and outside Palestine, whose aim was to prevent Jewish nationality or Jewish sovereignty in any part of Palestine. The third war is a minimalist war fought by the Jews, who were represented by the Yishuv and later by the State of Israel. The Yishuv was a pre-state organization. Jewish minimalists aimed to establish a safe national home for the Jews in Palestine in light of the 1917 Balfour Declaration. In the Balfour Declaration, Great Britain expressed support in establishing a national home for the Jews in Palestine, and in light of the 1947 UN resolution that for Palestine that recommended a two-state solution for Palestine. The fourth is a maximalist war for the greater Israel, and it was fought by the Jews. Some Zionists aimed to conquer all of Palestine, to displace Arabs from their homes, and/or to rule over them in a Jewish state. And this factual analysis, I believe that it is quite accurate, but there are a lot of debates, a lot of different historical narratives about the nature of Zionism, the nature of the Arab opposition to Zionism. I take it for granted without arguing for it, and I don't feel that I'm able to argue for this analysis. But this factual analysis, which will be the basis of my argument, it raises two normative questions. A, which of the four wars was just? And B, which aims should the just warriors in both sides, which aims should just warriors set for themselves in light of the fact that some of their connational and enemies fight for an unjust cause? The just war theory that the UN Charter embeds is not really helpful, and I want to explain why. It presumes, the UN Charter, just war theory, presumes that the society of state is governed by quote-unquote just arrangement, namely an established, conventional, widely accepted arrangement which makes for regional or global peace. Aggression is a violation, is a violent disruption of this arrangement, and as such constitutes a violation of the territorial integrity of states, which might be repaired by defensive war, a defensive war. The legitimate aim of defensive wars is to restore the peacefulness of the status quo ante, namely maintaining the territorial integrity and the sovereignty of the victim of the aggression. Importantly, it is not a just peace, but rather peace itself, as it existed before the aggression, which grounds the territorial rights of states. Just war theory does not imply that the current distribution of territories among states is just or desirable. It does not say that the way the world is divided is just or desirable. It merely prohibits redistributing territories or generating new nations, or dividing nations to two and things like that. By use of force, pursuing distributive justice or corrective justice is prohibited if it is pursued by force. Thus, a sovereign state, S, might truly believe that a neighboring state, I will call it failed, has no moral right over failed's territory, despite the fact that international law recognizes failed borders. Notwithstanding, a military intervention whose aim is annexation or a regime change in failed is morally impermissible, even if failed is a failed state, a corrupted, dysfunctional, and irrecoverably divided state. And if it is impermissible to use force against failed, even if it endangers its neighbors. It might well be better if failed ceased to exist and another state be founded on its stead. Still, such an outcome should not be brought about by use of force, even if it cannot be brought about by any other means. So this is how I understand traditional jus ad bellum. Now, obviously, the traditional, or almost obviously, the traditional framework is not applicable straightforwardly to the Jewish-Arab war over Palestine. In the relevant periods, the sovereigns of Palestine were the Ottoman Empire and later the League of Nations and the UN, which in their own turns empowered Great Britain to control it. On the face of it, like many other imperial rules, the rule of the Ottoman Empire was not fully legitimate, and by its very nature, the mandate for Palestine was a transitional regime. So, in order to understand the jus ad bellum analysis, the jus ad bellum of the Arab conflict between Arabs and Jews, what we have to do is to appeal to the underlying values that the traditional just war theory advances. If you believe in the traditional just war theory, and I'm one of the people who defend it more than others, so I'm much less revisionist than Alejandro, for example, or Helen or Victor. This analysis should identify the pre-institutional rights that the traditional just war theory aims to respect, so as to address two sets of questions. The first set of questions concern early Zionism, pre the Balfour Declaration. Prior to the Balfour Declaration, were the Jews a nation entitled to self-determination somewhere in the world? And I know that some people don't believe in the right of nations, especially ethnic nations, to self-determination, but the received morality of that underlies international law does recognize, I think, these rights, and I'm concerned with the received morality of international law. Did they have a territorial right over or in Palestine? Did they have a right to unitarily settle in Palestine pre-1917, despite the Arab opposition to this settlement. This is the first set of questions. The second set of questions regards the 1948 war. Was the 1947 partition plan just, or was it a desirable compromise? Or were the Arabs of Palestine justified, Arabs of Palestine and outside Palestine justified in their attempt to stop it by force? Which aims were the parties to the 1948 war were the parties entitled to set for themselves? And I'm going to offer two theses. The first one takes it as self-evident that the Arab inhabitants of Palestine had a right to self-determination in their homeland. Now, I do not say that they have a right to self-determination in a nation state, but they have a right to a certain form of self-determination, either in a nation state, a civic state, a multinational state. I cannot settle this question here. I take it as self-evident that Arabs had a just cause for war against Jewish colonialists who aimed to uproot them from their homes, to unjustly undermine their way of life, or to coercively rule over them. Furthermore, Arabs had a just cause for war against Jewish colonialists who implemented their plans to get over the whole land of Israel by peaceful measures like buying lands. Land buying might justifiably be considered to be a kind of a soft aggression. But I'm interested in a different question. Is the establishment of a national home for the Jews in Palestine is, in and of itself, a violation of the territorial rights of the Arabs of Palestine? The difficult question that the first thesis addressed is whether Palestinian Arabs had a right to use force against Jewish minimalists, whose aim was to establish a Jewish political home within Palestine, without intending to displace them or rule over them. And the first thesis asserts that if pre-1917 a partition of the land was normatively feasible, I know that it is a very, very loaded term, was normatively feasible, the Arab opposition to the Zionist minimalists agenda was unjustified. Normatively feasible, especially it did not involve uprooting people, expelling people, transferring people, or ruling them against their will. It states that the Zionist unilateral settlement involved no violation of rights that the Arabs of Palestine possessed. The second thesis that the larger study will offer addresses the full-fledged war that broke out by the end of 1947, after the partition plan for Palestine was accepted in the UN. I will assume that by then, no partition that truly allows peaceful existence of the two communities had been possible without a war. I will further assume that the partition of the land that secures two safe and legitimate states is the only way to end the violent clashes between these communities and create the basis of negotiation. And I will argue that if these assumptions are true, it follows that minimalists on both sides are allowed to fight for a safe national home for themselves. This should be the goal. But I have time, I'm okay. I have time to argue against one objection to the minimalist Zionist agenda and thus only very partly support the first thesis. The first thesis, I remind you, is that Zionist unilateral settlement involved no violation of the rights of the Arabs, no violation of the rights that the Arabs of Palestine possessed. Or to put it differently, the first thesis argues that what I call egalitarian Zionism does not violate the right of the Arabs of Palestine. Let me say something about the egalitarian Zionism. Egalitarian Zionism is based on a non-starter non-standard and yet tenable normative interpretation of three historical documents adopted by the Zionist movement, the 1917 Balfour Declaration, which I told you about, the 1947 UN Partition Plan, and the 1948 Independence Declaration of the State of Israel, and egalitarians, and I take this interpretation from the work of Chaim Gantz, who is, I think, the only philosopher that tries to analyze the Zionist movement and the ideology, or the ideologies underlying the Zionist movement in a systematic way. And I take his favorite interpretation of the Zionist movement. His favorite in the sense that he believes that this interpretation is philosophically defensible. And according to Chaim, egalitarian Zionism is states that by the end of the 19th century, Jews have formed a group that was entitled to a national home. Chaim is a nationalist. I'm not sure that I buy his nationalism, but I do take a nationalism to be a kind of a second best arrangement in a non-ideal world, a world that has a lot of nation states. Egalitarian Zionism insists that Palestine is an appropriate site for realizing the right of the Jews to national self-determination. Yet, unlike other normative interpretations of Zionism, egalitarian Zionism concedes that Palestine is a homeland of two nations. The the independence of declaration of the State of Israel says that the Jewish people has a right to be master of its own fate or something like that, like every other nation. And this insistence, like all other nations, implies that the collective right of the Jews to self-determination should not compromise the right of the Arabs of Palestine to self-determination in their own homeland. A partition of the land into two nation states offered in the 1947 UN resolution is not a compromise. It's a fitting and just arrangement, and it is not a kind of a rotten compromise. Not that there is no better solution. Probably if the Jews and the Arabs were able to live together in one state, in this piece of land, and to collaborate, and to create a kind of civic national identity, it would be better. But since this was probably impossible, then the partition was an acceptable and good arrangement. Now, there are many, many objections to the partition plan. And I want to, before I'm getting to the argument that I'm going to address, I want to offer, I hope that I have the time, what I take to be the valid argument. And the valid argument against the partition, the partition had taken place when both communities were on the ground in a conflict. But early Zionism should have predicted that this type of conflict and this type of resolution would be necessary. And the first Zionists had a very good reason not to bring about such an outcome, such a conflict, and why they had such a good reason against unilaterally settling in Palestine. It has to do with public order based objection, which asserts that the unilateral change in the status of Palestine is prima facie wrongful because of the tensions and the violent conflict that it was likely to cause. The status quo ante is preferable to the mutual suspicion and mistrust which a unilateral national settlement and the forced partition of territory are likely to create. the prediction the Jews and Arabs will not be able to live together in peace within Palestine had been reasonable given the history of colonization in general and the unaccommodating views that were prevalent in both communities in particular. The adverse effect of the Zionist settlement within Palestine results from a natural but tragic distrust between Jews and Arabs and their much less understandable degrading views of each other. The founding fathers of Zionism, and the first Zionist settlers, even those who were fully committed to egalitarian Zionism, should have known this and acted accordingly. Yet, there is a very good reason why Zionists, even egalitarian Zionists, decided to go for the Zionist project nevertheless, despite this predicament. and the reason is that the Jews all over the world were in a very bad shape. This is a good reason to solve the Jewish problem despite the enmity that those predictable conflicts will generate. Now, the question that I'm trying to answer now is, suppose that there is a kind of a lesser evil reason to ignore the conflicts. Did the invasion, did the settlement that Zionists were engaged in, it was a violation of the rights of the Arabs of Palestine? And the common objection to egalitarian Zionism relies on a view that they call Lockean nationalism. This is, as I read history, the main objection that the Arabs of Palestine raised against Zionism. Lockean nationalism asserts that a state can be justified in asserting territorial rights only if it does so on behalf of the national group that occupies an area of land. A national group, and I take it directly from David Miller, which seems to me to articulate this objection in the best way. A national group gains a territorial right if and only if two conditions hold. First, individuals, qua members of the group in question, adding material or symbolic value to the land. In particular, they were members of a group. They were members of a group agent that cultivated the land. They produced essential food, drained malaria swamps, built roads and bridges, and so on. While living in the territory, this group turned it to be its homeland by embedding it with symbolic value. This is the first condition, in virtue of which a group gains a territorial right over a land, according to David Miller. Second, and I quote Miller, there are no rival claims to parts of the land that could be recognized by redrawing borders. A territory belongs to the group that actually inhabits it, provided that the group's inhabitants of the land involves no violation of rights of another group. Now, the Lockean territoriality objection to egalitarian Zionism argues that, very simply, Palestine pre-1917 was an Arab land. The Arabs of Palestine cultivated it and embedded it with symbolic value by turning it to be part of their homeland. Therefore, they held a state-like right to veto the Zionist settlement in Palestine, as would the non-existent state to which they were entitled. An early Zionist thinker, the father of the Israeli right, to whose views I'm not really committed, but still I think that he put the Arab objection in a very good way. Zev Jabotinsky, articulation of this territoriality objection, reveals the centrality of the symbolic value that the Arabs of Palestine, some Arabs of Palestine, attached to Palestine. And he wrote it very early in 1925. Like every native population, the Arab people regards, and they quote Jabotinsky, its lands as its national home, of which it is the sole master. It will refuse to admit not only new masters, but even new partners or collaborators. This opposition is valid, according to Jabotinsky, even if it cannot be grounded in the occupancy rights of individuals. Indeed, the objection is valid even if there is room for a great many Jews in the country without displacing a single Arab. And even if practical concerns such as a guarantee against Arab displacement or equal rights for Arab citizens or Arab national integrity are resolvable, Arabs should feel at least the same instinctive jealous love of Palestine as the old Aztecs felt for ancient Mexico. And I believe that this voice was one of the historical voices that objected Zionism, early Zionism. Okay. And moreover, Jabotinsky, as a father of the Israeli right, had the same feeling towards the land of Israel, just as a Palestinian had the feelings over Palestine. So he thought there is a kind of conflict that cannot be resolved in a peaceful way. Now, I want to make two things in... I want to make two things in relation to this objection. I should first note that the underlying conviction of Lockean nationalism is very controversial. To see why, suppose that members of two different national groups desire to realize the right to national self-determination in one piece of land, the piece of land that they both perceive to be their homeland. Suppose that one of the groups is living in exile through no fault of its own. The exilic group was displaced. It had no opportunities to assimilate to another in another society, and so on and so forth. Contra-Lockean nationalism, the mere fact that one nation legitimately occupies the land and has added value to it, does not seem to be sufficient to make its sole owner. The interests of the members of the exilic group in a national home on this piece of land are as morally important as the interests of the members of the that occupy this piece of land. Partition of the land that fully respect the property and the occupancy rights of individuals and local communities might well be the first solution for it. So this is one comment. The other comment is, I will argue, that even according to Lockean nationalism, this objection to egalitarian Zionism is ungrounded. And this is mainly because Lockean nationalism does not draw a sharp distinction between the Lockean nationalism does draw a sharp distinction between the territorial right of a state and the territorial right of a stateless nation. True. For Lockean nationalism, nations are the prime holders of these rights, and not states. Still, the right of a legitimate state over its territory is, territory is one thing, while the right of the stateless nation over the territory within which it is entitled to establish a national home is another. And why is this is so? The distinction emerges from the following fact. The territories of a state typically include mountains and deserts that have been left uncultivated. And even where these natural landscapes take on a symbolic value, this does not usually determine whether the borders should be set. The Alps matter greatly to Swiss national identity, for example, but this does not help us decide whether a particular mountain should be Swiss territory rather than Italian or French. And this is a quote from Miller, the father of this conception of a territorial right. How then does Lockean nationalism justify the right of a state to its territory? Miller argues that the moral significance of state boundaries follows from the moral importance of states. Since boundaries of well-functioning states must be, quote, clear, continuous, and reasonably straight for reasons of efficiency, a state's territory might extend well beyond the territory to which the nation that this state represents added material or symbolic value to. Indeed, efficiency considerations justify the fact that a considerable degree of historical contingency enters into the precise placing of state boundaries. Contrary to the right of a territorial state, the territorial right of a stateless nation is grounded merely in the material or symbolic value it added to the land on which it lives. Hence, Lockean nationalism provides no determinate answer to a crucial question. What precisely is the territory of the future state to which Arabs were entitled pre-1917? Thus, states probably have a right to veto the establishment of another national home within their recognized borders, wherever these borders may be drawn. In contrast, the Arab of Palestine had no right to veto the establishment of a political home for the Jews aside the future Arab state unless considerations related to the material or symbolic value of the land rule out all feasible partitions. What would render a partition of Palestine wrong according to Lockean nationalism? One understanding of the symbolic value that Arabs embedded in the land should be immediately disqualified. For some Arabs, the very presence of another self-determined nation in Palestine compromises the symbolic value that their homeland has for them. Once we, and this is true, of course, of some Jews, the very presence of a national home for Arabs within Palestine compromises the symbolic value that it has, the land of Israel has for these Jews. Once we dismiss such exclusivist views, then there seems to be no reason to think that a partition that represents, that respects the territorial rights of the Arabs of Palestine is impossible, especially in light of the small numbers of Jews and Arabs living there in the relevant period. Okay. Now, let me end by saying this. It might be worried that the argument advanced above somehow justifies colonialism more generally. If only states and not stateless nations have the right to control immigration to areas to which native people haven't added material or symbolic value, settler colonialism would be justified in a wide range of cases, including America, Australia, and Africa. But I think that the worry is groundless. I hope that the worry is groundless. I understand liberal theories of territorial rights to imply that settler colonialism is wrong only if it aims to unjustly displacing people, at undermining their located life plans and national culture, or at political domination. It is wrong even if the settlement might negligibly but unintentionally cause displacement and destruction as a side effect. But if Europeans or Zionists were settling in empty or legitimately bought lands with no symbolic significance, and if they did not intend or foresaw, even if they did not intend to politically rule over the native people or to coercively displace them, their settlement probably involved no wrong.